This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. Today, I'm pleased to have in the studio with me Tim Messer-Cruz. He's dean of the Graduate College at Bowling Green, and he's the author of a provocative new book entitled The Trial of the Haymarket Activists, Terrorism and Justice in the Gilded Age. Tim Messer-Cruz, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Thanks, Matt. Glad to be here.
It's great to have you. I loved reading in the introduction about how you got into this. You kind of tripped into it by a question from a student. Do you want to tell that story?
Well, sure. I mean, the best research projects, I think, always arise out of teaching in the classroom, and that was the case with this book. I was teaching a labor history class at the University of Toledo, and I was using Melvin Dubofsky's Labor in America textbook. And we got to the section on the Haymarket riot. And in the textbook, it describes the Haymarket riot, and then it describes the arrest of the anarchists for the crime and the trial. And the textbook says the trial went on for 6 weeks, and but during that time, there was no evidence presented linking any of the defendants to the actual bombing. And one of my students raised her hand, and she said, "Professor, if they were in the courtroom for 6 weeks and no evidence was presented, what did they talk about?" And I had no answer. I had nothing. And I thought, I'll research this and find a quick answer to my student's question. And, well, it's 10 years later, and I think I finally might have come up with one, but I wasn't able to satisfy her at that time.
And you didn't just rely on secondary sources. You actually got a huge treasure trove of primary source material. How'd you get that?
Well, this is something that was my first discovery, is that there was quite a bit of unexamined material right in plain sight. You would think that an event that has been so widely studied and so widely researched, and in fact, this Haymarket riot is the subject of a published bibliography that now runs over 1,500 citations. So it's a very well-examined event. You'd think an event like that has had pretty much every stone unturned. What I first found out is that the very single most important source for this event, the verbatim trial transcript, had really never been examined by any of the scholars of this event. And it's quite understandable why. It's over 3,000 pages long. Only two copies existed, one in Springfield, one in Chicago. To read it, you had to sit in the reading room of an archive and protect the pages and so forth. Well, I had the advantage of researching when I did in the 2000s that the Library of Congress had digitized that document, so I was able to examine it from my study as opposed to driving to Chicago. And that just opened a whole window on the event that it almost seemed like an entirely different event than the one I had studied. The actual witness testimony describing the actual inner workings of the anarchist movement in Chicago, much of the forensic evidence, the whole course of the trial was laid out in this transcript. And that was a revelation to me. That was something completely new. And then there were some other important new sources as well that were, again, really widely available. One of the most important was the book published in 1889 by Michael Schack, who was the lead investigator of the Chicago police at that time. And Schack's book has been widely known. It's even cited quite frequently, but it's usually referred to as a very unreliable source, primarily because it seems on its face to be very biased. It's written by the police investigator, naturally. And Schack is also discredited because later on in his career, he was embroiled in a wide corruption investigation in the Chicago police force. Well, Schack's book is very interesting, though, because, first of all, he not only writes this book in something of a sort of penny novel, lurid style, but occasionally he departs from his narrative and reproduces what he purports to be actual investigation manuscripts or investigation notes of interviews with witnesses and so forth. And these were put in a different typeface from the typeface that was used for his narrative style. And checking those notes and those investigation materials against other sources, especially the witness testimony and other available sources, they checked out very, very accurately. Mm-hmm. So it seems quite likely that in the course of his book, he was actually using a lot of the documents that he had, but which are not available to us today. You know, I finally realized that Shaq, being accused of being a corrupt Chicago police officer doesn't make him unreliable. It just makes him typical.
Mm-hmm. And so why don't you tell me and tell the listener just the sketch of the Haymarket incident, and then let's go from there.
Sure. Well, the Haymarket bombing occurred during the weekend in May of 1886, the first weekend in May, which was the national deadline established by the trade union movement for workers to win the eight-hour day or go on strike. This was going to be the first national strike in American history. And that weekend in Chicago did begin with a large number of strikes. Tens of thousands of workers in Chicago went on strike for the eight-hour day. On May 3rd of that weekend, that was that Monday, there was a large altercation between strikers, employees, and police in front of the McCormick Reaper Works that resulted in the death of several workers. To protest that police intervention in that incident, the anarchist movement organized a rally for the following day, May 4th, at Tuesday night. And that rally was to be held down in a widening of Randolph Street known as Haymarket Square. In fact, the rally didn't actually happen on Randolph Street. It happened around the corner on Desplaines Street. It was a relatively small gathering for the anarchists. Only a few thousand people showed up. After about an hour and a half of speech making, the Chicago police in full force, over 160 police officers, shoulder to shoulder in rank style, marched up the street, read the riot act to the anarchist leaders, ordered everyone out of the square. And while that was going on, somebody threw a bomb into the center of the police ranks.
How many people were killed by the bomb?
Well, one officer was killed immediately, and that's a hard question to answer, actually, because to answer it, you have to look at the evidence for what type of wounds the officer sustained, because some officers were actually wounded by bullets after the bomb went off. My best estimate is that four police officers died as a direct result of the bomb, and three other police officers died as a direct result of gunfire following the bomb.
And there's a question as to whether that was gunfire from the anarchist crowd or crossfire from the police themselves.
Right. Well, for many decades now, the predominant idea has been that most of the police officers were killed by friendly fire, by the panicked shooting of other officers in the square, especially given how tightly packed they were in that single block. But there's really very little evidence to sustain that. In fact, there's very good evidence that there was gunfire taking place on both sides. Both the police and many of the citizens in the square exchanged gunfire. I think that's probably beyond dispute, I think, once you look at the actual evidence.
Another thing that's beyond dispute is the actual bomber was never found.
Well, the actual bomber was never apprehended.
Never apprehended, yeah.
I think the identity of the actual bomber is pretty well established by the evidence. Rudolf Schnaubelt, I believe, is very clearly pointed to by just about every reliable piece of evidence there is out there. So it's, one of the most frustrating things about this whole episode is that the man who physically threw the bomb was never actually brought to the court of justice or never actually clearly and finally identified. It's a problem of closure, I think, for all of us.
Speaking with Tim Messer-Cruz, he's the author of The Trial of the Haymarket Activists, Terrorism and Justice in the Gilded Age. I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor at The Progressive Magazine. This is Progressive Radio. It was interesting for me to find out that the police actually had talked to him after and apprehended him afterwards and let him go.
Yes, they did. And to understand how that could happen, you have to bear in mind that in the days following the bombing, the Chicago police were following their usual investigative practices, which was to haul in everybody even remotely related to the crime. So they literally hauled in hundreds of individuals into the stations, grilled them, tried to get them to give up other individuals, and that was the primary means of investigation in the 1880s. Schnaubelt was just one other individual hauled in this wide dragnet. So it's probably, you know, we shouldn't make too much of the fact that he was actually brought to a police station and questioned. Hundreds of people
were. But the police must have been tearing their hair out afterwards.
They were. They didn't have any clue as to actually who threw the bomb. It was only, again, through this laborious process today, which would have today would be a completely unconstitutional and illegal process of simply detaining people, breaking into homes, warrantless searches. That was, you know, standard operating procedure at that time.
And it's not unheard of even after 9/11.
That's so true.
It's
yes.
been known to happen since. In your book, you come to some conclusions that are at odds with the general interpretation of what happened at Haymarket, at least the general progressive interpretation, I think. Do you want to explain your conclusion?
Sure. Well, that is certainly true. I think there's a number of different conclusions that I think run counter to our popular notions of this event. The first is that I think our popular notions of the event are that the eight men who were tried for this crime were tried because of their beliefs and because of their writings and not because of any actions they actually took that weekend. I argue that when you really get down and look at the details, the evidence, when you triangulate all the witness testimony, and when you try and assess this trial and all the evidence as objectively as possible, you have to conclude that there was indeed a conspiracy to throw a bomb on May 4th. That there was a plan, that there was a number of individuals who were in on this plan, and that some of those individuals were on trial. Now, I'm not saying that all eight men who were convicted of that crime were equally culpable of that crime or equally implicated in that crime, but I think historically we have to admit that the revolutionary anarchist movement in Chicago was looking upon that May 4th weekend as an opportunity to spark a general insurrection of the working class. And that was their great dreams and hopes and what they were committed to do. And that's the significance of that weekend. We shouldn't deny that they were true revolutionaries, really in the mold of John Brown. I mean, they had come to believe that industrial capitalism was so intolerable and so immoral that it had to be combated and attacked immediately. Well, that's one conclusion I think that runs counter to our ideas. The other is that we have the idea that the trial was uniquely unfair. Many historians refer to it as one of the greatest travesties of justice in American history. Well, I've concluded looking at the course of the trial in the detail that I have that we have to put the trial in the context of the 1880s. And in that context, it was neither that unusual nor that unfair compared to other types of proceedings at that time. Certainly, it doesn't pass the sniff test by any means of progressive principles or values, or even the sniff test of what we would accept today as a legitimate courtroom procedure. But we can't project upon the past our own principles and our own morals. This really was a time period in which criminal procedure was just being developed, and standards and uniform processes of criminal procedure were only just then coalescing into what we would see as sort of a modern procedure. So many observers of the time in the 1880s looked upon this trial as being an example of the fairness of the justice system. Now, I wouldn't go that far, but it goes to speak to the fact that we just simply can't presume that it was unjust within the context of the 1880s.
In current context, what would you say was the most egregious thing that happened at the trial as far as violation of what we would consider the rights today to be?
Right. Well, probably the most egregious violation of rights would have been the widespread introduction of evidence that was seized without warrant. Almost all the physical evidence that was introduced in the trial was seized either from the offices of the Arbiter Zeitung, the editorial offices there, or it was seized from the homes of some of the anarchist defendants, all of it without warrant, proper warrant. And all of that would have been excluded today. There would be no question that that could not have been used against the defendants.
And it would have been hard to convict then. I mean, today it would have been hard to convict these guys.
It would have been very hard. Yeah.
And the other thing, some people have mentioned they had bad counsel. And from your account, it does sound like they had bad counsel.
Well, they did. And it was a combination of bad counsel, but also, I think, a strategic decision that was made early on in the trial, that the trial really needed to be a showplace for their beliefs. And it needed to be turned into a moment for this, for the propagation of their ideas, which, of course, trials are can be a good venue for that. However, there were eight men at risk of their lives here. And, you know, when you look at the strategies that were used by the defense counsels, it's pretty clear that they did not choose their tactics on the basis of what would lead to the best outcome for their clients. There was even a problem, I think, with all eight men having the same lawyers. Today, that would never happen. Each of the defendants would probably retain their own counsel, and they would be separately represented, and there wouldn't be the kind of decisions made that essentially sacrificed some of the defendants in an attempt to try and vindicate others.
Yeah, you said they would have been severed, each case unto itself, and there would have been better outcomes, if, at least for some of the defendants. But on strategy during this trial, it didn't seem to me that they were propagating their views really that blatantly, at least until the end, until their sentences. And then they just basically, half of them just kind of confessed.
Yes.
I mean, they didn't confess, I'm sorry, and ask for, mercy and
right.
seek contrition. They were absolutely proud about using dynamite and bringing on the revolution.
Yes, that's true. And of course, once the verdicts came down, they were freed in a way to really talk about their beliefs in a way that they could not while they were still in jeopardy of their lives. When I say that the trial was being converted into a showplace for their ideas, it's more subtle than simply taking the stand and giving a political speech. It was more in the sense of trying to represent themselves to the public as being more responsible and more committed for a type of politics that they really weren't committed for. Let me give you an example. I know I'm being a little vague here, but the best example, I think, is the decision to put August Spies on the stand. Now, August Spies was the editor of the Arbiter Zeitung, which is probably the largest circulation anarchist newspaper of that day. He was also a very learned, very erudite, articulate, charming man. And I think the decision to allow him to testify in his own defense was an attempt to sort of put a man on the stand who would put a good face upon their movement. There's no other explanation for why he would be allowed to testify other than the fact that they wanted to demonstrate that they were an intelligent, they were a very high-minded, and very, for lack of another word, charming group of people. They weren't these monsters, these lurking in the shadows, bomb throwing monsters that Thomas Nast might depict them in a cartoon. They wanted to show themselves in a better light. Well, that's all well and good, but once August Spies was put on the stand, it opened the door for a whole number of inquiries that should never have been allowed to be discussed in this trial. For example, once he was on the stand, he was asked about some of the materials that were seized from his office, including a package of dynamite and fuses from his desk. And he admitted that those were his. And he freely said on the stand that he did collect dynamite. He kept it in the editorial offices. And when he was asked what purpose he was amassing these materials for, he said, well, just for experimentation.
Curiosity, I think.
Curiosity. Well, I'm not sure that played very well with the jury. And it certainly opened an avenue for the prosecutors that otherwise would not have been opened. For example, they were able to introduce into evidence upon that some of the correspondence he had with Johann Most, who was the leader of the anarchists in New York. Correspondence where he had letters going back and forth saying things like, will you send the medicine? It was pretty clear they were talking about exchanging explosive materials for the males. All of this, I think, was very, very damning for the defense, and unfortunately, probably contributed as much as anything to the verdict of guilty.
The Haymarket the convicted guys at the Haymarket trial who were ultimately put to death are often called martyrs. Mm-hmm. You discuss this question, to what extent, how they were martyrs. How do you wrestle with that?
Well, I think it's a question of what they're martyrs to. They're certainly martyrs in the sense that these are individuals who willingly sacrificed their lives for the ideals they believed in. And I think we have to recognize their sacrifice in that way. The important point is that we have to recognize what that principle was they were sacrificing their lives to. I think, unfortunately, for many decades now, we've misunderstood what it was they were sacrificing themselves for.
What were they?
Well, the problem is that they've been painted over the years as being essentially moderate trade union activists. They've been depicted as supporting the trade union movement, the eight-hour day, incremental reform, another penny an hour, whatever it is.
Or Tom Paine pamphleteers.
Exactly, right. And this was exactly what they spent their lives fighting against. These men were revolutionary anarchists. They believed first and foremost in the revolution. They believed that there was no need to actually philosophize or talk about what happens after the revolution. Principles didn't matter as much as action. They were believers in immediate action. They believed that industrial capitalism was morally intolerable, just the same way that slavery was intolerable to John Brown. And they believed that they had a moral responsibility to take up arms and remove that that system forcibly. That was what they believed in. And they were the pioneers of many ideas which are still, have been for a century, common in some quarters of the left. For example, the idea of boring from within the union movement. In other words, supporting trade unions really for the purpose of working within them so as to convert them to the revolutionary ideology, make them into more a militant force than they would otherwise naturally be. They were really the pioneers of that idea. They were pioneers of the idea of propaganda of the deed. In other words, that one way to actually spread revolutionary beliefs was not through pamphlets or lectures or teaching. It was through simply taking action, violent action, that would demonstrate your passion for the issue and also hopefully exacerbate the tensions in society and maybe lead to that revolutionary moment.
Well, it's one thing to believe in the need for revolution and certainly to believe in the corrosive immorality of capitalism. But they weren't convicted of that. They were convicted essentially of the propaganda of the deed. And the question is, I mean, the fundamental question reading your book is that ever justified? Or is violence ever justified?
Mm-hmm.
And, for instance, one of the defendants in the trial quoted the Jefferson Declaration of Independence about the need to, you know, overthrow despotism.
Correct.
And so how do you wrestle with that?
Well, I don't have a definitive answer to that. I would say that, you know, in my own mind, I think many of us have come to accept that principle in many cases. I don't think any of us would question Jefferson and other revolutionaries of 1776 need to take up arms against the British Empire, or the abolitionists taking up arms against slavery. You know, the question is always hinges on the depth of the problem and the system that needs to be removed.
But the problem was deep, and the system was bad. And
it was.
And they did think they were John Brown, as you suggested. But on the other hand, they were foolish in thinking that by throwing a bomb at Haymarket Square that they would overturn capitalism in the United States.
You know, it looks to us very foolish, but we have the benefit of hindsight, of course. I mean, they had other examples in their minds. In fact, some of them had direct experience with just such actions which had seemed successful for a time. For example, in 1871, Parisian workers for a time overthrew their government and took over the city in the Paris Commune. Many of them were thinking of such examples themselves. They believed that Chicago was on the precipice of a similar moment. I don't think we can fault them as being naive or fault them for having some kind of wild idea that could never work. You know, from where they stood in the spring of 1886, It seemed to them that they were truly on the precipice of revolution, and all it took was a few committed individuals to really push it over the side. That's what we need to remember them for, not remember them as some sort of civil libertarians hoping to eventually and gradually transform society. That does them a great injustice in my view.
But you do fault them for something, even leaving aside the people who they killed, you fault them for setting back the cause of justice.
Well, and in fact, I think that is what happened, and I think we can fault them again with hindsight. I'm not. Perhaps they should have foreseen this. It's hard to fault them for their lack of foresight. But you know, in the end, the throwing of that bomb did set back progressive forces in America for quite some time. It literally ruined the 8-hour movement, which was winning at the moment that bomb was thrown. Most of the trade unions that were competing for the 8-hour day were winning that concession that weekend. It was a movement on the march. That bomb also destroyed much of the American left at that point in time, the existing, even the electoral parties, the Socialist Labor Party and other parties. Had been reorganizing and gaining at that point in time. This utterly led them into disarray. I think it's fair to look back and say this was a historic mistake for them to have thrown that bomb. This is something that set back progressive forces at that time. Do I fault them for it? I try and understand what they did.
What about faulting people who romanticized the Haymarket martyrs?
Well, there's been a lot of that, and it's a cumulative process. I mean, this process actually began as soon as the trial ended. I mean, the domestication of the beliefs of the anarchists began immediately once the trial ended, because the defense movement of the 1880s had to sort of reinvent their heroes in an attempt to save them from the noose. And so they immediately began denying many of the principles that they had previously stood for. And that, you know, of course, we want to do whatever we can to save people from capital punishment. But that set in motion really 125 years of misunderstanding of this movement. It got to the point where in the early 20th century, individuals were explaining their writings and their statements by saying, well, they were only saying those militant things to attract attention. They never really meant them. I think that misunderstanding is so deeply rooted. It's been going on so long. It's completely understandable that anybody would look upon them that way. Just pick up any book or article about the event, and it's pervasive.
We have only about 30 seconds left. Do you fear the romanticization of violence, of the propaganda of the deed among activists today?
Well, there's a danger of that. I mean, it's a very alluring and very deceptive philosophy, because it promises the individual the power to make wholesale social change. That's a very tempting proposition, but the consequences of that are so grave. And the method towards that, I would say, in my personal view, is potentially so inhumane that I would hope people would avoid the temptation.
Yeah, and wholesale social change, progressive change anyway, usually comes from movements, not from
individual. Well, that's indeed. And that was Marx deeds. And Engels' critique of the anarchists. They questioned the idea of immediate revolution.
We're going to have to end it there. Fascinating book, fascinating conversation. Tim Messer-Cruz has been my guest today. The book is The Trial of the Haymarket Activists. Thanks so much for being my guest.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.